One Easy Lesson. The speaker is Patrick Jackson, fellow PRSA and editor of PR Reporter, Exeter, New Hampshire.
To counsel anybody on anything, including and maybe especially your spouse or your teenagers, you have to believe in the tenets of what you're saying. My experience, and it's only my personal experience, although it is supported to some extent by a continuing annual survey of the profession that we do at PR Reporter, is that this remains a bit of a barrier for many of us in public relations. Confronted with an accountant and a stack of printouts, or a lawyer and a stack of citations, we cave. We don't have to cave. In fact, we have the upper hand if only we will really know the tenets of our profession and indeed bring them to that table, because that's what makes us of special value. If we didn't have these unique and different approaches, we wouldn't be necessary, would we? So it's just a total chicken and egg situation that if we want to counsel anybody, we really have to believe. As they say, a profession means that you profess something. So if you have never given much thought to what public relations professes as a social activity, I would suggest to you that good counseling skills for you and me and all of us begin with an inward look, being sure we know what public relations professes, what it adds to humanity, and then occasionally just going over that again to make sure that you and I each understand. My understanding of it is that public relations, as opposed to any other discipline, professes the uniqueness of the individual, that respect for that individual and the groups and organizations into which we form ourselves is what makes a democratic or self-governing society a possibility. Now, that ain't the worst thing to profess. And you got some great people to quote, George Washington, Tom Jefferson, Sam Adams. And yet, I find us very shy about this. It's kind of flag-waving. Flag-waving my eye. Have you ever known a lawyer that didn't talk about Justice so-and-so and Judge so-and-so and Blackstone? So I would suggest that the first step in being a consultant, and I preferred, by the way, the word counselor, because I think there is a difference between a consultant, which means, you know, we call somebody and they'll have a quick, ready, canned answer, and a counselor who leads us through the thinking process. But if we're going to be successful there, we have to know the tenets of our profession. Small commercial. If you don't have it, get a copy of PRSA's finally, at last, codification of the body of knowledge. If you want to be absolutely certain what the tenets are relating to the specific program you're dealing with at the time, it's right in here. It's easy to use. It's quick. If you find a reference that you need more detail on, the information center can fax you those pages out of the book or mail you overnight the whole book or the whole article. So here are the tenets, but if we don't use them and know them, we're not going to be very successful. Second point. If we believe, after that, how we apply those tenets strategically is everything. Strategy really is everything. I will take a strong strategy and weak tactical follow-through every time over a lousy strategy and emphasis on tactical follow-through. But there are two kinds of strategies that we require. One is obviously knowing and believing in the tenets of our profession. We have to understand how to strategically apply those to solving problems and creating opportunities. But what is our strategy for counseling our clients and our employers so that they will adopt our strategies in terms of our tactics? Because obviously they adopt them, we don't. And unless we think that through, public relations will always be doomed to real dangers, because more than almost any other profession or any other group within the organization, if our strategies don't work out, The kickback, the backlash, is incredibly damaging to the organization and to us. Most other people in organizations can screw up rather regularly, and nobody outside the walls will ever know it. You know that we can't. It's kind of like I have a young couple who are neighbors of mine, and they have this problem that those of you who have kids or can remember when your kids were younger will be familiar with, and that is that after they get to be two or three or whatever, you know how at night when you go up to bed, they all want to come dragging their little blanket and hop in with you. Kids go through that phase. Well, this couple has two kids that are quite close in age that are going through this phase. And you know, you don't get much sleep, it plays hell with your sex life, so you got to do something about this. So their strategy was that they didn't want to bribe the kids, they knew that was wrong. But their strategy was that if they would use a technique of a quid pro quo, if you will, that maybe this would work. So they would say to the kids, look, you know, we were all talking about going to the zoo on Saturday, and we're going to go, provided now that you get a good night's sleep and let us get a good night's sleep and don't come into bed. And as long as they stuck to real issues that were going to happen anyway, it seemed to be working. But then strategy was needed because one of them, daddy in this case, had to go off on a business trip for a week. So they thought, well, what do we do now? Well, their strategy was to do this, that daddy usually brings a gift when he comes home and, you know, gives it to the kids, says, I was in Phoenix and here's whatever. So they thought, here's what we'll do. We'll get him the gift first. And we'll give them the gift and we say, now look, here's your gift. But unless you stay in your own bed, the gift is coming back and, you know, you're not going to see it anymore. So he went away and it was a nice trip. And he came home and he got off the plane and he's stepping off the jetway, you know, into the airport. And this little six-year-old voice pipes up. You could hear it all over the place. And it says, Daddy, Daddy, guess what? Nobody slept with Mommy all the time you were gone. You see what I mean. In short, the best practice is worthless unless we can counsel people to adopt it, but the strategies that go into it have to be right. Let me spend just a few minutes talking about these strategies and these environments, and then I will share with you what we think we know about this skill called counseling. I'm sorry that I have to do this. There doesn't seem to be a lavalier, and they are taping this, so... Though I hate to do it, I'm going to play this game. First of all, I think we have to have a very clear understanding of what public relations can do in the organization. If you're not crystal clear on this and cannot give a simple diagram, you cannot expect your clients or your employers to understand what it is you can be allowed to counsel on. And so many of you are familiar with this, but as you know, some of us have gotten together and worked out a little plan of the three arenas in which public relations must, not can, the three arenas in which public relations must be applied in every organization. The first I will call mission support. If your organization is one where mission support means sales support or marketing support, fine. If yours is one that it means something else, fine. But all of those things that we traditionally do to make people aware of, hopefully to have some confidence in, our products, services, activities, the old bastion of public relations practice, if you will. One of our problems in counseling is that many of us think that's what public relations is, and that's all it is. And if indeed you're going to plop yourself in that arena alone, you're going to have some real problems counseling in terms of the daddy-daddy syndrome, and here's why. Because there's another arena that today is absolutely critical, and for those of you in the back who can't read it, that says public policy. Now, certainly I don't have to tell anybody after all the examples we've had that you can manage this kind of stuff, the routine of the business, great for 11 months. And in the 12th month, government or an advocacy group or somebody can change public policy, public thinking, and you either out of business or your 11 months of great work are wiped out. Well, management, however blind they may sometimes seem, knows this. We need to know it too. However, there's another arena, and that is the arena of organizational effectiveness. Organizational effectiveness. How about the organization itself? How do managers relate? How do employees relate? Work, teamwork, pride, you know all that stuff. How about the neighbors? How about the community? How about shareholders? Because whether we like it or not, they're part of the organization. Now, if we understand that there are those three arenas, and if we can simply give a diagram like this to our managers, even if they don't right away say, voila, I'll buy into that, you already are counseling, because you are forcing your fellow managers to think about the organization, how it operates, and what your role is. I suggest to you, that's counseling. You're leading them through a thought process. But, of course, the reason I say we have to do all three is those are a seamless web. You can do a great job here, and if you screw up here or here, you know that it can ruin this. You can do a great job here and have wonderful public policies, but of course, if you can't sell your product, then that doesn't matter either. So we've got to get across to managers, to our fellow managers, that there are these three arenas, and that we have this body of knowledge in which we believe that is useful in all three of those arenas. The next thing that we have to understand, in my view, is that within those three arenas, there is something very specific for which we are aiming. And that something is not communication, it is not opinion, it is not attitudes, it is behavior. If people don't do something about it, your boss could care less. And yet, I look at public relations practice and I see just vast numbers of our profession who think, well, I've sent the message, my job is done. I suggest to you, obviously you're free to take that position. I suggest to you, you will never become a counselor with that viewpoint, and moreover, you probably are an endangered species. When I talk about behavior, remember, I'm talking about doing something, not doing something, or just letting the organization try something. I mean, really, motivating, reinforcing, or modifying behavior. That's what we're about. It isn't the subject today, so I'm not going to go into it. There's a great deal that has been published on this subject, and so I'll leave you to your own devices on that. But the reason I say this is because every other discipline in your organization or in your client's organization is held to some kind of a behavioral measure. The salespeople, they can't control their whole arena. But if they don't make their quota, somebody hears about it. We can't control our whole arena either. But if we can't motivate some behaviors, then we're asking management to hold us to a lower and different standard. They won't and shouldn't do it. So if we understand that there's this broad arena in which we can work, that it's behaviors that we're after, the third step we need before we can really jump in and counsel is some kind of a process management system. Some way that we don't always have to go back each time we face a problem and say, now where do I start? What do I do? Let me share with you a very simple suggestion of a process management system, because this is essential to counseling. First of all, I don't have to tell this group, certainly anybody in public relations knows, that it all begins with your goals. And if these are the organizational goals, we all know that the public relations goals are just a tight fit. In fact, if you want a test of whether you are ready to be a counselor in your organization, take a look at your organizational goals and see whether any of them are indeed public relations goals. If none of the organizational goals are public relations goals, you know where you have to start counseling. Because you can have a wonderful set of goals, but the objective is to have some relationship goal to be part of the organization's ultimate objectives for whatever the near-term period is. This is a very simple system. I'm sure some of you will say simplistic, but let me try it on you anyway. The first question, if we know what the goal is to be able to help our clients, is to ask that basic question, who can help or hinder? Now, we all know about making lists of target audiences. The trouble is we usually make lists that include the universe. Here's the universe, boss, and we're going to reach them all just this year, maybe twice. If you don't believe me, go home and look at your own plans. Maybe we do fall into this pit. Now I'm talking about how can we target specifically those people who can help or hinder us here, and to have the backbone to say, look, we love the rest of you, but we just haven't got the budget, the person power, the time to get to you this year. There are no more mass markets, remember, no more mass audiences. The demographics people have made that clear, as has our own experience. So the first thing is who. When we're counseling, we know what the goals are. The first thing we have to think of is who. The second thing we have to think of is what behaviors do we need from the who to get to the goal. Now that may be simple, but do we really do that? Or do we think in terms of process? Gee, we'll do a video, or wow, we'll have a meeting. That's not what counselors do. Counselors think, who do we have to move to do what? And then we ask them, well, if those are the groups that we need to get to, now let's get realistic, because we know that really today the way the world works is that we have to get to the opinion leaders in that group. First we identify the target groups that can really help or hinder, forget the rest. And then we say, this is what they need to do. And then we say, now we know we can't even reach all of them, so who are the opinion leaders in those groups that are going to motivate them? And notice what's happening now. With our limited resources and limited time, now we're narrowing the field to a few folks that we can identify person by person, or at least by a tight profile, and we can go out and talk to those people. Remember, public relations. Now we're going to be able to build relationships with individuals. Now you're starting to talk about hitting pay dirt. However, the trouble is people don't just go to behaviors immediately. If your ultimate behavior is to have them purchase a product or buy into a political position, the trouble is there are certain intermediate behaviors that they need to do first. And this is part of the genius of having a process, is so we don't kid ourselves by starting right out saying, oh, well, we want them to take up our position, when we know darn well they don't know what that position is. They may even be opposed to it. So our real strategy is to find out those intermediate positions and lead them through those so we can get the ultimate behavior. If you want to sell a car and you're always telling everybody, buy a car, buy, well, how do you react to that when people come to you and say, hey, you want to buy one of these? Come on. But if they say, hey, you know, we're having a little session this weekend to explain how the new braking system works, or I don't know what it is, some kind of intermediate behavior that just gets you to take a look at and try the situation, now you're on to a key point of counseling. Because when our clients hear us talk about these big ultimate behaviors, they're dubious. They should be dubious. If we understand that we'll lead them through this step and this step and this step, it's also great protection for us because they know it won't be done by next Monday morning. A couple of more steps. Obviously, we've got to probably have some research in here so that we know where these people are to move these people to these behaviors to give us these to give us the meeting of these goals. And then we're into strategy and tactics, and I won't spend any time on that. But notice what I'm talking about, a process system, so that as soon as you are sitting in the management meeting and the problem or the opportunity comes up, you immediately can go through four or five steps. The key to the research, by the way, is to ask, how ready are they to give us these behaviors? Never mind all this wonderful long-term positioning of their opinions. You need their behaviors. You need it now. We need a new kind of research that checks their latent readiness to give us those behaviors. Okay, so now we have a body of knowledge that we understand. We have a belief in that body of knowledge. We understand the arenas, and we know we've got some kind of a process management system. And if this one doesn't work for you, work out one of your own. All I'm suggesting is that if a lawyer or an accountant or an engineer or an architect approaches a problem or an opportunity, they don't have to sit back and say, where should I start? There are rules, and they start with one and they go right down the rules. When we can do that, guess what? People start having confidence in us. It's like going to the tailor. If the tailor says, gee, there's a rip here, I wonder how I fix my sewing machine to deal with this, you would probably grab your torn item back and go to the tailor next door. Believe it or not, that's how we come across. That's the perception that's given if we don't have an immediate process to go to. So if you want to be an effective counselor, you got to be able to demonstrate that process. All right, so we've gone through now all these key materials. How are we actually going to practice counseling? Step one, there is a mindset difference between being a strategist and being a technician. An absolute mindset difference. These kind of process questions, what is the goal? What are we really trying to do here? Who are the folks we really need to get to? What are the behaviors we need? Asking those kind of questions, that is what a strategist and a counselor does. A tactician immediately starts spouting activities, and it's just back to the daddy-daddy syndrome again, because we look like all those other key questions are not important, and we also look like all we can deliver are those tactics. So first, we as strategists have to lead our fellow managers to the agreed-upon goal, and we cannot accept that the goal they have put forward is necessarily correct. Now that's a tough part, is questioning, asking the what if this, are you sure of that, what's the evidence, what's the research? Sometimes you'll get some backlash on that. Listen, I'm the CEO here, I've been here 30 years, I know. When I hear those words, I know from a client, you know what I do know? I know, man, this is going to be a long, profitable consultation. It's probably going to go on for a very long time, because if people are so sure they know and won't listen to the what-if questions, then there's a danger. It's now become an emotional issue and not any longer a setting of goals. So first, as strategists, we help our client set the goals. Then, once we've agreed upon the goals, we go to the bottom line and we talk about behaviors that are necessary to achieve those goals through this process, because that's what they expect. Now, there are three kinds of consultants, and it's important that we think about this, because it positions us based on our own particular skills, but also, unfortunately, some of these are better than others. You can be an expert consultant, and I use the word consultant. They call you up because you know, and you spout off the answer. Or you can be what they call an extension of management consultant. What that means is they call you in and they say, look, I couldn't really handle old Joe over there, so I need you to handle him for me. Many of you, I'm sure, get into those situations. And that's not always a negative, but it certainly can be. And then there are collaborative consultants. Now, a collaborative consultant is the consultant who indeed, just by acting collaboratively, positions him or herself as part of the decision-making team. Because you are asking the questions, you are participating, you're not saying I have the answers, you're saying I do have some ways of looking at the problem that may make better solutions. If you are an expert consultant, notice the difference. You are the preacher. I have the answer. Obviously, in basic human relations, that doesn't go over very well. Furthermore, the danger is this. The boss comes running out of the room and says, Jackson has a solution. Notice, Jackson has a solution. And 2 days later, when it doesn't work out, Jackson is not with us any longer. Whereas down here, the boss comes running out of the office and says, I have a solution. And something wonderful immediately happens. Everybody rallies around and says, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard of, but by God, we're going to make it work because it's the boss's idea. That's the difference. Now, an extension of management situation is a very dangerous one. Sometimes you will legitimately be called upon to take this position. All of us are. The problem is to make sure that the people we're counseling understand that we work with the authority of management. In other words, we are merely there as a surrogate. And if you don't cut that deal quickly, Management will say, well, I didn't tell Jackson to do it. Jack, what's he doing? You've all been there. Shove him out, solve the problem. It's worth a try. Dangerous. And yet, sometimes very necessary, because our bosses and clients can't always solve the problems down in the organization or outside, and sometimes they will give us the assignment. The point here is that we have to cut an absolutely negotiated deal with our client that, okay, we'll take on that challenge, but when we speak for you. And if that means we check with you every morning at 8:30, fine. But don't shove us out on the limb, because all that is, of course, is just suicidal for us. Yes? Sure, the question is, are they looking for somebody to absorb the blame and the antagonism? And I leave it up to you. I mean, you know, that's one of the roles of the consultants. The reason that our rates are high is because a consultant, as you know, is someone to have around to blame for the failure. And that's okay, and that's fine. But many of you are internal counselors. And oh boy, the danger here. But it's also bad on us external counselors. We'll talk more about some skills that go with this later. Let's talk for a minute about the counseling process. What do we know about this as a psychological and sociological activity? Fortunately, there's a lot of information on this subject. And I should warn you, however, that when you go looking for models, you don't really find them in psychology and sociology. Unfortunately, you find most of the models in psychotherapy. Well, you see, only the psychotherapist really can study an individual human response. And so that's where we get our models. Here's the counseling model, as best we know it. It begins up here when the counselor first confronts the situation. Now, I want to caution you about that word. I'm using that word here very denotatively. The counselor just looks at this situation and asks the what-if questions, tries to make sure that there's a real managerial understanding or misunderstanding, and at this point, we don't say anything if we're sensing a misunderstanding. We're merely confronting the situation. And as I say, the key question here is, well, what if? What if that wasn't true? I just came off a situation last week. Involved some public activist expressions against a client. And the client was just absolutely beside themselves, because the particular group and the issue, the group doing this and the issue they're doing it on are supposedly pretty hot stuff right now. But of course, the first thing we look at is, well, what are the real numbers? So, you know, we get out the census data on our good old block-by-block census. 5%. 5% of the people. So here they were all shook up. Well, 5% of the people. So then we say, well, now let's take another little look. If 5% of the people feel this way as the group that is pushing this issue, how many of them do you suppose right now have nothing else to do besides get involved? Well, you look at some of the involvement models and you immediately take 10% of the 5%, because 90% are too busy. Going to be Thanksgiving, Christmas is coming, shopping is more important than anything. And so you start narrowing this down. Pretty soon we can tell the blocks or the districts in which these people work, and now we can deal with the situation. But if you sit there and you say, oh my God, everybody's against us, soon they will be, because you will do things that will lead them to that position. So it's those what-if questions. Confront the reality. Having confronted the reality, however, then there's another step, and that is jointly with our client, we clarify the situation. In other words, we gather the data. We do what is necessary to show that our confrontation wasn't just us being stinkers. We're playing devil's advocate to try and make sure we know what we're really up against or what the opportunities really are. So over here, jointly with our client, we clarify. We decide, hey, let's do this piece of research, or hey, I think Tom might know something about this, or hey, maybe the accounting department has some data. So you notice you start out confronting, and then you start moving toward collaboration. And usually, however, this has been a somewhat painful process. There's some give and takes, and there are moments, you know, when your client looks at you and wants to ask that classic question, whose side are you on anyway? So then you move towards what some consultants call the bartender role of consulting. And that is, having shaken your client a little bit, for heaven's sakes, take a minute then to give them some strong support. You know, John, boy, I really feel, you really got a problem here. I'm right beside you all the way. We're going to be able to lick this. I know it looks tough, but I'm right here and my troops are right here. Whatever it is that will give them that build up again, because now comes the clincher. The clincher is, how do you offer them some expertise? You've confronted the issue, jointly you've clarified it, you've let them know you really are on their side, and now it's time to make some decisions. And here is where most all of us counterintuitively destroy our trustworthiness as counselors. That is exactly what we give them, is we offer them the answer. The rule in counseling is crystal clear. We do not offer answers. We only offer one thing, and that one thing is options. And it's a difficult, difficult role to know how to do that. The boss says, look, I'm paying you to know these answers. Tell me what you ought to do. To which you say, well, it looks to me like you have two choices. You have two choices, or we together have two choices. And even if one of those choices has to be to do nothing, in other words, you could do X or you could do nothing, we have to give them the choices, or else, remember, it's Jackson's idea. In order for consulting to be effective, the ideas have to belong to the person being counseled. And if we give them the answers, then it's all over. So isn't it just as easy to give them two or three options? And usually there are three or more options, yes. Of those two options, what do you think? Then you say, well, this one has the following pros and cons, and this one has these pros and cons. It's a little bit like tennis. You ever watch the tennis match on television? All those heads are going like this. Well, the ideas are going back and forth and back and forth. What I'm suggesting to you is that if it gets to the point where they're absolutely demanding that we have to give them this option, and we have to do it, we have, to some extent, lost. Unless we're good enough to quickly start making sure now, well, this is what I would do, but how do you feel about this? Can you buy into that? Can you own that? You know, boss, I mean, if it's my idea, those other troops out there aren't going to really grab it. So you gotta own this. In other words, I'll lay it right in his door. You got to own this. That's why I'm giving you options. I'm not trying to duck this. It's just that let's be clear here. See when you're a counselor, how you can say all those process things? If you position yourself as a counselor, whereas if you position yourself as a technician, they don't want to know how the Xerox runs. They just know they want 150 copies right now. Well, it's the same here. You've got to position yourself first to be in that spot. Now, the options business may be tough, but the options business also works. You know, I worked my way through college partly by selling Fuller brushes. Everybody should have to do that. It's probably the best training for building relationships that you'll ever find. And the first thing they teach you is this theory of options. When the Fuller brush person or any intelligent salesman comes around and they see that you have an interest in something and maybe you're sort of getting hooked to buy, they never, if they've had any training, say, would you like one of those? Because you see, there's two possible answers, yes and no. So the Fuller Brush people are trained to say, would you like one or two? You see, the only answer is yes. The question is quantity, you see? Well, now think about that. That's wisdom that has worked in a genius-like way for salespeople for a long time. When you're a counselor, whether we like it or not, you are selling. And isn't that the funny thing? You're selling in a way that they're making all the decisions. Because what you're selling is sound decision making. You're helping them make sound decisions by putting them through the ropes of all the elements that go into sound decisions. There are a number of techniques for how you get the permission of your organization to do a lot of counseling. And I don't care where you are on the totem pole now, if you're a new hire, just got there last week, let me share with you what the OD counselors, the organization development counselors, long ago developed as an almost foolproof method. It's as close as we've got anyway. The first thing is a step that they call making entry. You have to make entry into the problem. And this can be so simple. If you sense something that really needs attention and it doesn't look like anybody's attending to it, go to the executive in charge of that and just maybe catch him at the water cooler or coming out of the John or something. And just say, oh, Charlie, you know, we've gotten some information that suggests we could have a problem over in the north side. It's no big deal for you yet, but is it okay if I look into it? You know, Charlie's probably hurrying to lunch or something. He probably says, yeah, sure, you know, look into it. And if he's got his wits about him and says, no, don't look into that, okay, you know where you stand. You haven't made entry. When you get back to your desk, however, you don't want to leave it to chance. So you drop him a little note and say, Charlie, I just wanted you to know we are looking into the subject you and I discussed at the door of the men's room on Tuesday, and I think I'll have some information for you by next Wednesday. So in other words, you've made entry, now you've nailed it down. You've gotten permission. You've gotten licensed to look at the subject. Now, if you're licensed to look at the subject, that means a lot of things can start happening. So you do a little bit of data gathering, a little bit of looking into it. And don't do too much at this phase, because if you do too much and you come back with a full report, see, now you're the expert. You don't want to be the expert yet. You want to go back and work on the next phase, which is called contracting. You go back next Wednesday and you say, Charlie, we did look at this. I talked to Tom. I gathered some quick secondary research that we did 2 years ago, and I noticed that the tide over there is rising. I think we got a problem. So you and I think, ought to talk about how we're going to gather the current data. How are we going to really now be sure of this? And who should we involve in it? In other words, you make a contract. Now, sometimes that may be your last act. They may say, boy, thanks a lot, Sally. I'm going to give this to Mary to carry out. Okay, nothing lost. You have brought an important issue onto the table and acted as a counselor. Counselors can never expect closure. After they're magnificently successful and you've counseled right, they may not remember you were ever around 4 years ago. If you need ego gratification, get out of this field. It just doesn't exist, and you all know that. So after you've done the contracting, usually out of that will come some kind of a data gathering phase. In other words, you do go out either alone or with some other people and you gather the information that really nails this subject down. Now you know in proper proportions, proper perspective, what it is that's happening. So the next step is you call the feedback meeting. You call the feedback meeting. You go back to your client and you say, okay, this is what we found, here's the report. And notice what's happening now. You're still not the expert. You have the information, but the client asked you to gather the information, collaborated with you on the methods to gather it, and so now notice what you're doing? You are sitting there elbow to elbow, level to level with the client. Great position to be in. You are now counseling, because after you look at the feedback data, the two of you or the group of you together diagnose what this means and what should we do about it. Often out of that diagnosis session will come an action phase in which probably you will be deeply involved, or maybe you won't be involved at all. But notice what you have done. You have now acted the true role of a counselor. Remember, in psychotherapy, you cannot preach at people who have a personality or a habitual or behavior problem. Doesn't work. And so psychotherapists never say, this is what you should do to stop your heavy drinking. Instead, they force you to confront that you are a heavy drinker. They clarify the details of your heavy drinking. Then they give you a lot of support, and then they go through the expertise phrase, something like this, and you decide that's what you want to do. That's what's happened right here. The idea now is implanted, it's strong, and you did it. And most of the time, since you were there at the beginning, you will be asked to have a key role in this. Now, there are a number of techniques that are important in making this happen, and since we have a very limited time, I want to zip through and share some of these techniques with you. There are a lot of elements here, I understand, that we're bypassing, but you can't do everything in an hour and a half. First point, when you draw up your own individual or departmental public relations plans for the year, public number one should be your senior management. Your senior management. And when we counselors draw up our plans, public number one should be the client. I can't tell you how often we all overlook that. I'm as guilty of it as the next person. And yet, if we don't treat them as a public that needs the same attention, the same strategizing, the same continual reinforcement and questioning, we're not apt to be as successful. And here's why. Trust is the ultimate ingredient here. And if we have built some trust, then we're going to be effective counselors. In fact, that's the trouble today. We can give bad advice, and if they trust us, they'll still take it. I mean, look at Ronnie Reagan. We took his advice for 8 years, and now look where we are. Because we trusted him. He was the ultimate trust figure. One of the things, after we've targeted them as our number one public, is to understand how what we call the real world test. And by the way, I think all of this should be very, very open with the client. I mean, I will use these exact things I'm sharing with you to the client. It's a little fearful. You may be seen as lecturing a little bit. So you obviously say, well, let's just kind of review, you know, what we all know about this. You know all those little phrases that make it okay to go back and give them PR 101 for the 4,000th time, or organizational behavior 101 in this case. Because remember, every organization has four systems within it that are all competing with one another and that have to be taken into account if whatever it is you're planning to do is going to be effective. First of all, of course, you have a technical or a task system. The tasks, the technical tasks that are necessary to produce the product, service, positions, whatever. That's one system. Then, we all know, of course, there's a financial system. How about the budget? Can we afford this? What are the accountants going to say? What's the effect on the stock price or the surplus at the end of the year? And then, of course, there's a good old political system. Vice President A and Vice President E hate each other, and it would take their cooperation to make this happen. For God's sake, let's not get in the middle of that. Or if we're going to do that, let's do a little OD counseling with them first. And then, of course, what we love to overlook, but as Peter Drucker keeps pointing out, the most important system is the social system in an organization. Remember what Peter says. Every organization is first and foremost a human family, a social system. Now, you got these four systems. Which ones of those do management control? And which ones are beyond management control? And so how then can we guide management to have a realistic look at this real world in which the ideas have to be floated and hopefully succeed? Within these systems, we need also to look very hard-headedly as counselors. Remember now, it's us and the client together. We're in the office. We've decided what we're going to try and do, what the behaviors are, who the people are. We need to make it work internally and externally. So we're sitting down now. We're taking a look at the real situation. So we got to ask ourselves, who are the decision makers here? Maybe we're talking about the opinion leaders in a customer public. Maybe we're talking about certain executives within the organization. So we want to know who are the decision makers, and then, to show our real understanding of how the world works, then we want to say, okay, in order to reach them, let's not leave it to chance. First, we're going to find out who the direct influences on that decision maker are, and then we're going to find out who the indirect influences on that decision maker are. And if necessary, if it's important enough, we're going to work the whole system. This, believe it or not, is the gospel according to Irving Berlin. Irving Berlin wrote a wonderful song during the First World War that I suppose most of you have heard about, "Oh, how I hate to get up in the morning." Well, in that, there's a wonderful line that goes like this. He says, "And then I'll find that other pup, the guy that wakes the bugler up." Well, this is the bugler, and I want to know who wakes him up. Because if I can find out who wakes him up, now I can make things happen. Counseling. This is the...